Hello and welcome to QSO. And I want to ask a question. Have any of you ever operated the little three-tube night kit AM radio broadcaster when you were a kid? Did you ever build one of those kits? Have you ever used a Henry Engineering matchbox at a radio station somewhere, or in the ham radio shack, or at home on your stereo? Well, our guest this week on QSO is Henry Landsberg, WB6MEU, a former employee with the Drake Chenault Company. And he's going to talk about his experience with the night kit broadcaster, his ham radio career, and his company, Henry Engineering. And this is a real interesting QSO, so be sure and stay tuned. We'll be right back right after this. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing.
How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello. Tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air, but don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. Our guest today is Hank Landsberg. And Hank is the, I'm going to assume you're the Hank in Henry.
I am he. Well, I am it.
Well, you know, for years, I mean, I remember reading in the handbooks and stuff, the Henry amplifiers and all that. Your call sign, WB6, is at MEU.
Right.
Okay.
Now, one thing I should clarify is that Henry Engineering and Henry Radio are two entirely different companies. So I'm not part of the Henry Radio that started way back in the 30s and that made the amplifiers and all that, you know, RF ham radio gear. sometimes there's a little bit of confusion between the two of us, but my company does audio gear for the broadcast industry.
Okay, and but you know what? It's interesting because I was confused on that because I had somebody tell me, I don't remember who it was now, hasn't been that long ago, that it was one and the same company, and I thought, because I remember now the Henry Engineering part, or Henry, not Henry Engineering, Henry Radio, I guess it'd be what it was, at one point manufactured some FM broadcast transmitters.
Yeah, they did. They sort of crossed into commercial broadcast gear some years ago. I think it was maybe, maybe 15 years ago or so. And I'm not sure if they still make them or not. But that only added to the confusion because I started my company in 82, and it was right, I think it was in the 80s when Henry Radio got into the commercial side as well. So, as I say, that sort of added a little bit of confusion between the two entities.
Well, see, that's interesting because I know there's a lot of folks sitting in the same chair that I'm sitting in that have thought that the two companies were all the same. Same person, same company.
Nope. Two different companies, and we get calls all the time from people looking for replacement parts for the Henry commercial transmitters, and occasionally from hams looking for replacement parts for Henry linear amps, and I have to tell them they've got the wrong company.
Well, the reason I remember the Henry broadcast transmitters is one of the very few, actually the only FM commercial broadcast transmitter that I've ever seen, that when you press the on button, the filament comes on and the high voltage comes on all at the same time. I mean, it's like bam, and it's it's on the air, you know. And you know, and engineering people like myself, you want that warm up time. You know, you want a little time for the filaments to come on. You know.
Yeah, you'd think there would be some delay in there.
Oh, well, these are the ones I worked on. Those things, you hit the on button, they were on. You know, and I guess maybe that was, you know, maybe, you know, see, somebody knows more than I do. Let's put it that way. You know, it's probably fine. Probably nothing wrong with that. You know, just that you get used to things being a certain way, and that's the way you expect them. You know.
Yeah.
I saw a product. You're listening to QSO, and we'll be right back with our guest, Henry Landsberg, WB6 MEU. Right after
week
this.
After week, you hear us talk about Trans World Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews. Or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And, of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com.
At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look for your email. And now back on QSO to Henry Landsberg, WB6MEU of Henry Engineering. Of yours, just recently, which was a USB audio interface to go on to, obviously, a computer which had audio inputs. And I believe it had balanced XLRs on it, and I don't know what all it had on it. I just remember seeing the thing. It was really intriguing. And I was curious. Now, you are the manufacturer of that particular unit, are you not?
Yeah, that's typical of the broadcast audio and professional audio gear that we make. In fact, we just came out with a new version of that device called USB Matchbox 2. And as you said, it's for interfacing professional balanced line level audio to a computer. And what it does is it essentially takes the place of the sound card that is usually built into the computer. So you plug it into the PC with a USB cable. And since it's USB, you can use it on a Mac or on a Linux system as well. And then it has four XLR connectors on the back for stereo balanced in and stereo balanced out. And then the fifth one is a digital output, which is the AES professional digital standard for outputting digital audio from a device. So, yeah, that thing that you're describing is a Henry Engineering product, and we make lots of various audio interfacing and control interfacing products, most of which are geared to the professional commercial broadcast industry or pro audio, such as recording studios and commercial sound and those kind of various pro audio applications.
You know, Bob Heil has really opened up a can of worms here in the ham radio department. He starts producing all these great microphones, and all these guys want to improve the fidelity, you know, on the air. So now we have to have toys from Henry Engineering, because we're wanting to interface computers with audio, and we need little mixers and switches and things like that. And even though this parallels the broadcast industry, there's a lot of amateurs that would be really intrigued by the stuff that you make, because all of this falls in the goal. You know, once again, let's blame Bob Heil, okay? Because he started all
this. There's always been a lot of sort of cross-pollination between the ham radio community and broadcast, because an awful lot of broadcast engineering people have gotten their start as hams. I mean, that's where I started, and that's probably where you started, and I mean, lots of people have, graduated from ham radio into commercial broadcasting, and the hardware does the same thing, you know. Sometimes ham radio gear finds its way into the commercial broadcast end of things, or vice versa. So, yeah, that's okay with me. If people want to use my stuff on ham radio gear, that's I suppose it'll work. It doesn't know the difference whether it's going out on 100 megahertz or 2 meters or 40 meters.
Well, you know, I was going to say, on the front of your website, there is a unit called, I believe it's called a 6 mix.
Right.
T- tell us about this 6-mix, because now this is something I could see really could have some application. There's a lot of fellas using mixers and whatnot. The thing is most notebooks, most computer notebooks, the inputs on the things are actually mono when you get right down to it. I mean, they're,
right.
And a lot of the input, the audio inputs on them, are pretty sad.
Yeah, and they're usually mic level without any real RF suppression, because nobody expects to use a laptop computer sitting next to a ham rig. But the 6-mix is a compact audio mixer that we came out with a couple of years ago. And there are lots of small, inexpensive audio mixers on the market. You can get them for, you know, as little as like $79, $89. But they're not intended for broadcast station applications. And there's a whole host of differences between a live music mixer versus a radio station mixer. And in most cases, they have to do with elements of switching and control, not so much audio quality per se, because there's really no difference there, but simple things like how do you turn the microphone on and off? That's something that's essential in a radio station, but not if you're mixing a live band.
I'm looking at a picture of this thing up close. And it kind of I didn't realize this is what this was. But let me tell you what I see here. This looks almost like, or it has the same sort of approach or layout as the Autogram mini mix of some years ago. In other words, it's
kind of similar because it is a broadcast console, so it has functions on there that you only find on a broadcast mixer. On-off buttons for the mics, cough switches for the mics, talk back, mix minus, a cue circuit with a cue speaker. Those are the kind of things that you'll never find on a live music mixer. So, yeah, in a lot of ways, the 6-mix is similar to the Autogram unit, and similar to larger broadcast consoles. It's just kind of shrunken down into a smaller package.
Okay, now I'm looking at this. Now, you have to excuse me, because this is the thing. My good friend Ronnie Millsap, before KCG, is now doing podcasts. And we were looking all over for a friendly console for an unsighted person. They couldn't see. So you have to have something to where when you push the button it's in, and you release the button it's out. You know, I was looking on this unit. Is that the way these switches work? I mean, you push them in and they go down and stay down, or does it just light the LED? And
no, they're mechanical latching buttons. So
when
you push
the
button down, it's down.
Well, this is,
if you have a good, you know, sense of touch, you could tell just by feeling the button whether the thing was up or down.
Well, this thing has,
so
I'll tell you what.
Yeah, the 6-mix is really ideal for podcasting because it functions like a radio station mixer, and since it's got a built-in USB, in fact, the USB matchbox that you mentioned a few minutes ago is essentially built into the 6-mix. So by taking a USB cable from the 6-mix to your PC, now you've got digital audio interface between the console and the computer for stereo recording and playback, and you're completely bypassing the usually lousy quality sound card that's built into your PC or your laptop. So the whole idea of the 6-mix is that you could take it and plug it into a PC or a laptop, and now you've got a radio station on your desktop. You've got all the functionality of a big radio station console in a package that's about the size of a laptop computer.
Well, you know, the thing of it is you've got a cue switch. Now, in broadcasting, the difference between, say, for example, a regular mixer that someone might have and a broadcast mixer is that the broadcast mixers or the broadcast boards always had Q. So you could turn pot all the way down. Usually at the very minimum setting of the potentiometer was a detent, especially when we had the old wire-wound Davin pots and whatnot. You'd turn it all the way down, hit that click, and then your source material would pop up through the Q speaker.
Right.
And you couldn't do this with a... With a Mackie or a Behringer or an Alesis.
Yeah,
or,
you know, you're right, because when you're doing a live music mix, or what I call mixing a garage band, there's no need for that function. So you'll never find a cue circuit or a cue speaker on a live music mixer. In fact, if you're on our website, if you click on the picture of the 6-mix...
Mm-hmm.
And then that'll take you to the 6-mix page. If you scroll down to just below the photo and start at the second paragraph where it says, many stations have attempted to use small live music or PA mixers, you'll notice that text is underlined there,
mm-hmm.
Live music or PA mixers. Click on that. And what that'll do is take you to a page called the Console Comparison, where it compares the 6-mix with your typical live music PA mixer.
Oh, let me tell you something. In the radio business, in the broadcasting business, the biggest headache in the world is using one of these. Now, this is me, okay, and I've been asked to install them in a lot of places, and I've put them in. And they're great quality. I have nothing against the Mackies in these production rooms, but they are such a pain because, you know, there is no stereo pots. Well, I guess there is some on some of them now. Of course, there's still no Q. But none of the pots are stereo. It, like you said, it's not set up. You've got to worry about some sort of a muting system for the microphone. And, I mean, there's just a lot of headaches. And radio guys that have been raised in the radio business, they have a hard time operating in that environment, you know, because they've got to remember right, left on all these pots, you know.
Yeah, it's just not the right device for the application in a radio station. And I mean, everybody knows Mackie makes some of the greatest small portable mixers in the world, but they're not intended for radio studio use. So when people ask me what the 6-mix is all about, I usually answer them by saying, well, if Mackie made a small broadcast console, this is what it would be. But Mackie's not in the broadcast industry, really, so they don't, you know, they don't address this particular application. But
now, let me ask you a question here on the 6-mix. What is the little auto cue button on the thing? What does that do?
That's a cool little feature. Imagine you're a DJ and you're doing a live show. And the way you, as you were saying before, on the old broadcast boards with rotary pots, you know, you turn the pot all the way down and it would click into cue. Well, we can't do that on a small mixer because nobody makes small potentiometers with that kind of switching. So the next best thing is to use a separate button. And on the front of the 6-mix, on all the line input channels, you'll see the blue cue buttons. So whenever you push a blue cue button, it puts that channel on the cue speaker. Well, let's say you're a DJ and you're doing a live show and you're playing CDs and you know, whatever. And normally you wear headphones and you've got speakers in the control room, but you're wearing headphones also. So you can, you know, so you can hear yourself when you're on the air with a live mic. In order to cue something and hear it through the headphones, which is often the most convenient way, because if you've got your speakers turned up in the studio, it's hard to hear a little 2 or 3 inch cue speaker. So what I put on the 6-mix is a function called auto cue. And when you engage the auto cue mode whenever you put any source on the cue bus, it automatically switches your headphones from program to the cue bus. So now you can cue stuff up through your headphones, and you'll still hear a little bit of the program mix sort of in the background. But what it does is when you put any source on the cue bus, it takes the main program mix from the headphones and dims it back by about 20-25 dB and puts the cue bus up at full volume in your headphones so you can cue things up prior to air. Or you can audition stuff before you put it on the air.
What is
and then when you get it queued up, then you release the cue switch for that channel. So now that channel is ready to go on the air live. And as soon as you release the cue switch, your headphones revert back to normal program audio. So it saves you the hassle of continually having to manually switch your headphones back and forth from program to cue. It does that for you.
I guess the thing I was going to say is that when you're in a remote location, somebody's trying to do a broadcast, there's always, in a remote situation, there's so much extraneous noise. You can never hear the cue speaker on anything. I don't care what it is. You know, it just isn't.
Yeah, you can't, because the cue speaker is usually small. In this case, it's built into the mixer, and it's really small. It's a little speaker that's really intended for use in a laptop computer. So, if the room is quiet, you can hear it. But it sure is more effective if you got headphones on to be able to cue stuff through the headphones, especially, as you say, if you're at a remote, doing a remote broadcast someplace and there's all kinds of noise and interruptions and stuff going on around you, being able to preview and audition things through the headphones is a whole lot more effective than trying to hear a 2-inch cue speaker.
Now, let me ask you this question, and I should admit this could be a loaded question. Does this thing have any mix minus on it at all?
Yeah. That's another one of the functions that you'll never find on a live music mixer because there's no point in it. But on the 6-mix, yes, it does have mix minus. So if you're doing a talk show and you've got a hybrid, you need to be able to take mix minus audio, which is your main program mix minus the incoming caller audio, and you feed that back to the caller so the caller can hear everything that's on the air.
And that's exactly what I'm doing right now with you, utilizing our Telos One. And and you know what? There's so many consoles out there that have no broadcast consoles. I mean, I know right now of a couple of Wheatstone consoles. They're not the actual Wheatstone. It's the what is it? Audio Arts. You know that the people at those stations would would give their right arm if the thing had a mix minus out on it. You know, it's just a pain. You got to work around.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just one of those essential things that you need in a real-world radio studio because everybody uses hybrids these days. Everybody puts either they put phone calls on the air at one time or another, or they record caller audio for one reason or another, and you have to have a mix-minus output or you can't make the hybrid work.
Well, this is really an innovative piece, and I'm sorry, folks. All of the folks out there that are amateur radio operators and you're listening to this, these old broadcast junkies get carried away here on the radio talking about audio gear. But if you've spent as much time in the broadcast business as I have, you long at times. That's one of the reasons why I loved, and I still do. Matter of fact, I operate and run and own an Autogram Minimix 8 because it's small. And it's built like a broadcast console. And that's what I don't want, one of these crazy recording studio consoles when I'm doing radio.
Sure. And I'm sure you know as a chief engineer of a radio station, you never want to give a disc jockey more knobs and buttons than he can figure out what.
You're listening to QSO, and we'll be right back with our guest, Henry Landsberg, WB6 MEU, right after this. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth.
It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right now.
If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna, and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Transworld Adventurer 4040 Array Box in center section only, right now only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Transworld Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide, and in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with a deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Transworld Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Transworld Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040.
Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, dot com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, "I want to win." Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast, but be sure and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, "I want to win." Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look for your email. And now back on QSO to Henry Landsberg, WB6MEU of Henry Engineering.
To do with.
Oh, and one of the biggest problems, too, and I'm going to say this, the radio stations run into this, where guys go in the studio, and everything today runs on a computer. We don't play CDs anymore. We obviously don't play vinyl. But
what happens is a lot of times the CDs are recorded real time. In other words, they're not necessarily ripped. There's these ripping programs that digitally transfer the music into the computer, and those are preferred, although I've seen some pretty strange things happen during the ripping process that's not supposed to happen. You know,
yeah.
Like level changes,
yeah,
and things like that, you know. But a lot of times these guys will record music on a console, and what they'll do is they add EQ to it.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are inexperienced, so consequently what you get on the air out of that piece of music is a sonic horror show.
Yeah. You never want to give a disc jockey or an inexperienced person the ability to change the gain structure or the EQ of your broadcast facility. I mean, you go to a lot of work and effort to, you know, keep the levels in the right place and assure that you've got good headroom, and then the last thing in the world you want is for some guy to go in there and crank up the bass by 10 dB because he thinks it sounds good in his headphones, you know, not realizing that now that's the way that thing is going to sound on the air, whether you want the EQ or not. So certain things like EQ and pan pots and effects buses and things like that, which are commonplace on recording boards and remote small live music mixers, you don't want that stuff on a radio board because you don't want people to turn those knobs.
And you know what? I've seen some things take place where there was some sort of a bizarre problem and nobody could figure it out. And actually what it turned out to be is somebody had turned the EQ switches, the EQ up or down or something along that line, and or pan something to the right or left. You know, we have a spot running on the air, and they say, well, that's weird. It's only on right channel, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just somebody in the production room had inadvertently flipped the pan pod either to the right or the left and just didn't realize what they had done. So, anyhow, well, I want to go back in time a little bit, and I want to ask you, are you familiar? Oh, I may get shot for this now, Hank. Are you familiar with the little three-tube night kit little broadcasting device you used to be able to pick up for $11.95 from Allied Radio Shack?
I have one sitting less than 10 feet from me. The AM broadcaster, the one with the purple knob on the front. It uses two 50C5s and a 12AX7. And I built mine when I was about 12 years old.
Well, the call sign, let me think here, is it something like KCHZ? I mean, have you ever heard of that station? Or is that?
Yeah, but that one came much later. When my night kit broadcaster went on the air, it was KHGL, operating somewhere in the vicinity of 860 kilohertz, and it covered the metropolis of Hastings Ranch in Pasadena with however many milliwatts the thing put out. But, I remember, in fact, I wrote an article about that thing for Radio World magazine, or newspaper, about 20 years ago. But, I had one, and I still have it. It's sitting right here on the desk. And KCHZ came along, many years later, as a result of... Well, you know, when you have RF in your veins, that's just the way it is. And I started my first, quote, real job in radio was, in 1974, working for a company called Drake Chenault Enterprises. And Drake Chenault was a programming syndication company that took the Bill Drake radio formats and created that same sound on for FM radio using automation. What passed for automation back in the 70s, in other words, lots of reel-to-reel tape machines and cart machines and all that sort of thing. So I went to work for Drake Chenault in 74, and then since I was working out there, of course, I had access to the whole library of automated music formats, and I thought, well, geez, all I have to do is add a transmitter here, and I can be on the air with big-time sounding radio. So that's where K-Cheese started.
Well, let me ask you a question. Did you ever get Johnny Mann to cut you a jingle package?
You know, somewhere here, I do have some jingles, but I don't think they were done by Johnny Mann. They were done by, I forget the guy's name. It may have been, let's see here, the guy who wrote the book, Ken R.
Hmm.
Ken R. cut me some jingles many years ago, although I don't know if I ever actually used them. But what I used, my radio station, KCHZ, was at 104.7 and used the logo of Z104. Well, conveniently, Drake Chenault had a client station in Madison, Wisconsin, WZEE, and they also were at 104 point something, and they also used the logo Z104, so I just made a copy of their jingles. So when KCHZ was on the air, it sounded totally professional and totally, it sounded commercial even though it wasn't, but it had the Z104 Drake Chenault jingle package, and it ran a top 40 format that was called XT40. It ran on four reel-to-reel tape decks and three or four cart machines for jingles and weather and that sort of thing. There weren't any commercials, so I didn't really need much more than that. And the whole thing was controlled by a homemade automation sequencer that I built out of a surplus phone company type stepper relay. And the automation was called the Cheese-O-Mation. and the Cheese-O-Mation ran reasonably reliably. So I would load up four or five decks with format tapes, and the format tapes had music with built-in announce tracks and my jingle package, and when the thing was running on the air, it sounded tight and professional and really on top of it. So that's where K-Cheese started. I think it first went on in about 1975 or 76, and it was on for quite a few years up until about, maybe 10, 11 years ago.
Well, I'll tell you something.
That's where it started.
I'll tell you, and for those that are not, that don't have any idea what we're talking about, and I don't like doing this because I frequently will wind up alienating a part of the audience, but We discussed, what we started talking about was this Night Kit wireless broadcaster. And this was a three-tube unit that you could get from, was it Allied Night?
Allied Radio in Chicago. They were like $11.95 or something, and this would be in about 1962, 63. And, you hooked it up to a piece of wire, and the thing would transmit for about a block.
Yeah, it was. Here's what I discovered, though, was interesting. When I was a kid, and I don't know, did you ever see the little L-shaped chassis that Lafayette used to sell, the phono oscillators?
Yeah, similar.
They were similar. They were kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
There's a lot of exposed wires there on that little L-shaped chassis. Now, the shocking thing, literally, about the Night Kit, as well as the Lafayette, was they had a hot chassis, which is something that most folks you've never seen before, but one side of the AC line connected directly to the chassis.
So if you reverse that thing in the wall outlet and you had it plugged into something else that actually was grounded, it was quite a surprise.
you could get a little surprise. This was before they had polarized AC plugs, so it was a 50-50 crapshoot as far as whether you plugged it in the right way or the wrong way. I mean, your basic 5-tube radio was the same way. The chassis was grounded, but those things were in a plastic case, so you couldn't touch the chassis. But with the Night Kit thing and the Lafayette thing, the metal chassis was right out there, and fully accessible. And like you say, one side connected to the chassis, if it's the neutral side, you're okay. If you plug the plug in the wrong direction, then you got 110 volts sitting on the chassis.
Well, I've got a picture of myself sitting, when I was a kid, sitting in front of this, I had a bunch of ham gear there, too, but I had the phono oscillator, and I had Lafayette made a four-channel mixer. A little tiny thing ran off a 9-volt battery, and I picked up a microphone. I believe it was a Turner, a little plastic mic. It was like a ceramic microphone. It was ceramic, and then it had, the phono cartridges were ceramic. They were Sonitones.
Yeah.
So I had two turntables, I had a microphone, and a Voice of Music reel-to-reel tape recorder. And I was able...
You were all set.
Yeah, and the phono oscillator. Well, here's what I discovered about the phono oscillator. In the back of where I lived in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. And this is before I advanced into building a higher power transmitter. But if I ran a wire back to the phone lines, there was a sheath that went up and down. It went the length almost like cable would today. And it was a big, fat, round sheath inside of it. It must have been a million wires. But the outside of that sheath was, how do I want to say it? It almost looked like a soup can type thing that followed the entire line, back
like a big
and forth.
Shield.
Yeah. And if I took a bare wire and wrapped, in other words, threw a rock around it and kept wrapping the thing up so I had a nice good connection there, ran it back to my phono oscillator, then anywhere within probably 3 square miles, if you got near a telephone with a radio, that phono oscillator would come in just fine.
Oh, so the phone company was your antenna.
Well, yeah, it was like a carrier current station,
Yeah.
Operating. Oh, it was wonderful. It was really wonderful. And it was really weird because I used to take my transistor radio and I'd get on my bicycle and I'd ride down the alley. And I'd turn left and I would follow those phone lines and it seemed like I could just ride and ride and ride. Now, of course, the problem I had is if you had a 30-minute reel-to-reel tape on, it was over. And if you put on of course, you could stack some LPs up on a, because I ran record changers. I didn't have the ability to get regular turntables, And those things are kind of a pain, to work with. But I had made a trip into Detroit, or actually Lincoln Park. A friend of ours worked over there. And I was able to go into the studios of WLIN. I think that was probably that and WMUZ in Detroit were the two first radio stations I had ever seen the interior of. And your mind goes wild. You begin to think, because I remember watching those guys do remotes, and on the turntable bases on the bottom, they had AC light switches, and they turned the turntables on and off of those light switches. I thought that was kind of novel. But anyways, those little Night Kit broadcasters, I guess I want to say I kind of miss that part of it, because were you able to get much range out of it at all? I mean, how far would the thing go for you?
It would go about a block. You weren't supposed to use more than 10 feet of antenna wire, but, of course, nobody paid attention to that. I had a wire on top of my parents' house that was probably 40, 50 feet long, and I don't know how well it coupled into it, but it was you could hear it for about a block.
Boy,
I think it was, 100 milliwatts or something like that?
Yeah, I think that's all it was. The thing of it is that they were, I had one of those, I had several of the little Lafayette oscillators, and then I'll tell you what else I had, what really got my appetite wet, and I've never seen one since.
I saw pictures of one. My dad had picked up this thing, and it was a 78 RPM. It was like a little record player in a black suitcase. In other words, it was about the size, about double the size of a good sized briefcase. And when you opened it up, there was a turntable and a tone arm. I swear it was made out of lead, and you had to change the needles in this thing, you know, and you could play these 78 RPM records. And in under the underside, of course, I had to take it apart. Was an L-shaped chassis that ran, I think it was a 25Z5 and something else, some other tube. And the line cord was resistive. In other words, the when you plugged it in, the line cord dropped the voltage somehow.
Whoa.
And it ran those two tubes and a piece of wire, and you could play a 78 RPM record and tune it in on an AM radio. And of course,
okay.
I had to take that thing apart. I pulled the electronics out of it, and then I had to couple an antenna into it. It was just crazy. But the thing was quite ingenious, but I've never seen one except I saw a picture of it on the internet. But I think they were fairly common back then. I don't know if they were made by Zenith, if they were made by who made them, but they were just called, I think they were called wireless broadcasters or something.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, you could play the 78s through all the radios in your house. So I remember tuning it into our big floor standing Stromberg Carlson, which had like a 12-inch woofer in it or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And it really sounded good. It really did. But you know, that, of course, you'd have to figure out a way to get a microphone on it, you know, and you gotta But I saw that. No, actually, I saw that article on the internet posted somewhere. And when I saw the night kit and I saw that your name was beneath it, I said, we've got to talk about the night kit broadcaster. And I wonder how many other people out there have done the same thing. You know?
There must be thousands of guys in the broadcast industry who had one of those things as a kid. I should take mine to an NAB show one of these days and just put it out on display and see who recognizes it.
Oh, I bet you.
In fact, I had one, and the kid who lived two doors away from me, I built one for him also, and we tried to make them into an intercom to go between our houses, you know, a wireless intercom on two different frequencies, and it sort of worked. I don't know. I wonder how many of those things they sold. I'll bet you there are 5,000 or 10,000 of these things were out there at one time or another.
I wonder what it would cost to build those things today. Now, you'd have to isolate the chassis or you'd wind up killing someone.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I wonder what the... wait a minute. They sold for $11.95 back then.
Yeah. Which, actually, you know, for 1962, that was probably the equivalent of about $100 today.
More than likely. And, you know, I don't know. There's something, though, about the little solid-state devices today. I don't care. They just, you know, there was something about the tubes lighting up, and the audio on the thing was not bad either. I mean, it didn't sound bad at all. Of course, there was no limiting of the frequencies either. I mean, you had full range on your AM radio. No NRSC clipped.
No, but they always hummed too. There was always a ton of 60 hertz hum on the carrier for whatever reason.
I think it was just a weak power supply. There wasn't enough filtering in it, obviously.
Probably so.
You're listening to QSO, and we'll be right back with our guest, Henry Landsberg, WB6 MEU, right after this.
Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
That does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971, and Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, Bubba!
The beat goes on.
CKOW, the Motor City.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen. Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert, cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to a vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the big HCKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the rise and fall of the Big 8 from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the rise and fall of the Big 8 is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW.
It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it. And we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna. And it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out. Transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right now. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello. Tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month. And we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air. But don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. And now back on QSO to Henry Landsberg, WB6 MEU of Henry Engineering. But for $11.95, you know, it was a real gem. Well, now, okay, you know, just recently, Bill Drake passed away.
Yes.
And I was fortunate enough to get to know Bill and to be able to talk to him occasionally. We exchanged a lot of information back and forth when we did talk. But he was such a recluse that half the time you didn't know if he was mad at you or... you know, he just didn't want to talk to anybody, you know. but one of those occasions when I did talk to him, as later on down the road, they became more frequent. And matter of fact, she calls herself his domestic partner.
Carol.
Carol and I are very good friends, and we talk back and forth quite a little bit. And I guess, you know, working for Drake Chenault, you were right in the middle of it all. I mean, you were right dead center. And I don't know, I don't know what his involvement was. Was he heavily involved with the company when you were working there?
Well, as far as the automated radio formats go, I don't really know how much he was involved with that, because by the time I got there, which was in 74, they started the company a few years earlier. I think it was 70, right around 1970, 69, 70, something like that. And I know he was heavily involved with it when it was created, you know, at the inception. But I think by the time I got there in 74, I think he was not too much involved with the day-to-day automated format side of things. But a few years after I started, in about 70, let's see, 77 or thereabouts, we decided to produce a new version of the History of Rock and Roll. And he got back into the picture at that point, because that was one of the things he was involved with originally when the History of Rock and Roll was first produced at KHJ in, I think it was 1969. And so Bill got involved with the production of the Drake Chenault version of the History of Rock and Roll, which started in around 77, I think. And he brought with him a couple of the guys from the KHJ days, Bill Mauzes and Bill Watson, in addition to the lead studio production guy at Drake Chenault, whose name was Mark Ford. And when we got to the point of getting ready to start actually recording the show, of course, they had to find somebody to do the narration. And they auditioned a few people. They finally settled on a guy, and I'm trying to think of his name right now. Oh, geez, now I can't remember his name. Anyway, he was a guy who did a lot of commercial work in L.A.,
That wasn't Robert W. Morgan, was it?
No. It'll come to me in a couple of minutes. In fact, if I go to the website, maybe that'll remind me.
I'm thinking of the same person you are, and why
it's the guy who did commercials in L.A. for a company called Cal Stereo, and I still hear him on the air now and then. Eventually, I'll think of it. Anyway, we brought him in and recorded and produced the first couple hours of the show, and they didn't like it. It was too high pressure. It sounded too much like a sales pitch,
mm-hmm.
And they scrapped it and kept on looking for somebody else to do the narration. And then it occurred to somebody, hey, why don't we ask Bill Drake? And basically he said, geez, I was waiting for you to ask me. So he came in and started to do the voice track recording for the History of Rock and Roll. And that was the first time he really became sort of re-involved with the company. Because up until that point, you never saw him out there. He never came out.
Oh, he was a recluse. He was
in the building.
Matter of fact, I had several friends of mine said they were really, really surprised that he and I conversed as much as we did, because he just was reclusive. That was just his personality, his nature.
Yeah, I don't know if he was reclusive, but
maybe private is a better word.
Yeah, I would just say he was a private kind of person. And what he did, what programming and whatnot that he may have done for the company prior to the history rock and roll, he just did from his house. You know, there was no reason for him to come out to Canoga Park. So, and he lived, and, when I first started there in 74, he was living in Beverly Hills, which was a good hour away. And then a few years later, he moved to, I guess it would be considered West Los Angeles. But you never saw him out there. Drake Chenault was in Canoga Park, the west end of the San Fernando Valley. And the only time he came out there on any kind of regular basis was when we started cutting the voice tracks for the history of rock and roll. And I had been out to his house several times prior to that, but never really had much of a chance to get to know him. But when he was out at the studios for the history of rock and roll stuff, in fact, one of the days when he was out there cutting voice tracks, I went to him and I asked him if he would cut me an ID for KCHZ.
Oh boy!
Which he did, and it was right around the time, maybe a month or two earlier, KHJ had dropped their top 40 format and gone to country. So I had Bill cut me an ID that said, "Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Bill Drake. Now that KHJ has changed to country, I listen to Z104, KCHZ-FM, Pasadena." So I would use that on the air on rare occasions, but that was just, it was kind of a fun thing that he did for me. But that's when he kind of got re-involved with the company, was when he was out there doing the voice track recording for the history rock and roll, which he usually did sort of in the late afternoon into the evening. I kind of got the feeling he was a sort of a night owl. So that's when they would do it.
Yeah, he was up all hours of the night.
And you could get a
phone call from him on rare occasion when he made out going phone calls. It was not uncommon to get a call from him at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So,
uh-huh.
And in the early days, he would monitor the stations, and he was, I guess, known for being the one that would call the overnight guy at 3 a.m. and say, "You just didn't do that right."
They had monitor lines in the early days anyway, to all the RKO stations that he and Gene Chenault consulted. So he would be monitoring. Of course, the jocks wouldn't know that he was monitoring because they had no way of knowing. But
you just assumed that he was listening 24/7.
You had to, yeah, because if you strayed from the hot clock and did something that you weren't supposed to do, the phone would ring and your butt would be on the line.
What an era of radio that Bill Drake was really responsible for. Now, Carol and I have talked about this, and she told me the story of him injuring himself, and I can't remember now what sport it was he was involved in, but he injured himself, and because of that injury, it took his interest into the radio business. He got interested in radio. Otherwise, he may have been an athlete, you know, but because of a sports injury early on. And I know she made the comment to me in an email one time. She says, "I wonder how many professional music careers that injury is now responsible for, you know, because without Drake," and I maintain this, because if CKLW did not exist in Detroit, Michigan, I'm going to say 80% of what we grew up with in terms of Motown would have never happened. It would have never happened.
Yeah.
CKLW was the driving force in the music industry. And, of course, all of that was the original design of Bill Drake. And, of course, the fella with the earphone in his ear.
Gary Owens.
No. The... It's right. Just slipped my. I don't know how I could forget the guy's name. But anyway, so that's what happens when you get my age. Goodness. If we had Jim Davis on the phone, he could tell you instantly the man's name because he took so many phone calls from him. And matter of fact, the fellow that I ran into at Dayton that used to work at Keener in Detroit, I think he didn't like the guy very well. I think the guy, sent him out the door. But he was a little bit overbearing. But he was heavily schooled under Bill Drake. I can see the man's face in front of me right now, but for some reason I can't remember his name. It'll come to me in a few minutes. But anyways, all of those concepts that were employed at CKLW, obviously at KHJ, WOR, RKO, WHBQ, Memphis, all of those RKO stations all were Bill's original concept.
Right.
And we've lost so much since then. I mean, a lot of folks totally misunderstood the Drake radio format. They thought that Drake got rid of the personality. They say now today, well, he got rid of personality radio. That's just not the case. The people that worked at CKLW, and as you know, the real Don Steele, Robert W. Morgan, all of those people were heavy radio personalities, but they were structured. And
yeah,
they didn't just ramble on and on and on and on in between the records. It just didn't happen. Paul Drew was the fellow I was trying to think of. I don't know why Paul's name just went right out of my head. And the radio was approached in a different manner. In other words, people on the air sounded like they belonged on the air. They sounded very natural for radio. They weren't necessarily screamers or people that that put on a false DJ voice. They just were very professional, very, very professional.
Yeah.
And there was
there were sincerity to it, you know.
You could tell
it was real. They were the real thing.
So much care went into the actual presentation. Where today, I mean, we were up in, we went for a little ride yesterday. We went up in Cookeville, Tennessee, and there's a group of stations up there, and we noticed all their vans parked in front of the building. So Matt, my son, pulled into the parking lot, and we kind of drove around because we saw the STL dishes high up on the towers, little tower in the back. And Matt says, "Ha, I bet there's nobody in there." Three radio stations just run along. Well, if a tornado come through, nobody would ever know. And it is so changed so radically because with Bill Drake, of course, later on, the automation systems became a necessity, you know, but that was all part of the changes that took place in the radio business. But if you go back to those live days of radio, when Drake had his, I guess, five pages of rules in place at those stations, there was nothing else like it on the air, period. So I'm curious now. I remember when CKLW got rid of Drake Chenault, and the next thing we knew, we had Hit Parade appeared on WJR-FM in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember listening to Hit Parade, and it had that same flow to it. It had that, I don't know how to describe it, but once you tuned it in, you really didn't want to tune out. You wanted to stay right with it. And you were involved in a lot of the production of these formats, like Hit Parade.
Oh, yeah. Well, Hit Parade was the first automated format that Drake and Chenault put together. And that's where the whole idea of automated radio that wasn't elevator music, that's where it started. And when I first got there at Drake Chenault in 74, Hit Parade was still... they were still using that name for the MOR format, and by that time there were several other formats available that were variations, you know, of it. We had, initially I guess about 100 stations, and by the time we got to the late 70s, we were up to right around 300 stations running various versions of the automated music formats. In fact, I put up a website about 5-6 years ago. It's drakechenault.org, and it's all the technical stuff of how we produced those format reels and kept them so tight and consistent and maintained very high audio quality and quality control, which was necessary in order to get a format that would sound good on the air, you know, with tight segues and consistent levels and all that sort of thing.
You know, it's interesting, and we talked about you don't want to turn a radio station guy loose with an EQ control when they're recording stuff. But I ran across some of the old Drake Chenault reel-to-reel music tapes. Now, you'll see them on eBay, and people sell them on eBay. I don't know where they get them or where they get probably radio stations somewhere, you know. And I've got several of them here, and I put them on my Revox B77 and let them run through. And it's amazing because one thing I noticed immediately, and that was the EQ and level on each one of those songs was so consistent. How did you guys do that? I mean, because you had to EQ some of this music. You had to play with it some.
Actually, we almost never EQ'd any of the music. The secret was really good studio gear, although you wouldn't necessarily know it from looking at the original studios, which were kind of patched together. But we were using, Sony turntables. Originally, Sony turntables, and that migrated to Technics SP-10s. But we were using Stax UA-7 tone arms with Shure V-15 cartridges. And right there is a departure from what you would normally find at a radio station, because a Shure V-15 would never hold up in a live radio.
No, you'd bend the stylus.
I mean, you'd be replacing the needle every couple of hours. So it started with a V-15, a Marantz high-end audiophile preamp. When the Berwyn pick and pop and dynamic noise filters came out, we put those in all the studios. And the way we got the consistency was at the head and the tail of each master tape, where there was a complete set of alignment tones that were recorded for level, EQ, head alignment, and phase. And we did that at the head and the tail of each reel to be sure that nothing changed throughout the reel. And when the studio engineers were producing the masters, the master reels, they were pretty careful about, you know, watching levels and keeping things consistent and all that kind of thing. excuse me. There's a lot more to it than what I'm just telling you now. And if you go to drakechenault.org, there's a button there called Behind the Scenes in the Production Department. And there's about 10 pages of technical stuff with photos about how we did all that. The situation we had to deal with was, on a typical automated format, there were basically two groups of tapes. There were basic library tapes, which contained sort of the core music of the library.
You're listening to QSO, and we'll be right back with our guest, Henry Landsberg, WB6 MEU, right after this. It's the 4040. It's a new 40-meter monoband antenna. It looks just like the Adventurer or the TW2010. It's the perfect antenna for high-performance DX communications in a portable package. This antenna system is ideal for camping, emergencies, or
permanent installation where you gotta go stealth. 7.0 to 7.3 megahertz without the necessity of either manual band changing or the need for a controller. Just attach the feed line and you're ready to talk. That's the Trans World Adventurer 4040. Go to their website. Take a look. Transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, "I want to win." Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, "I want to win." Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL. And we'll look for your email. And now back on QSO to Henry Landsberg, WB6MEU of Henry Engineering.
Which, and those reels were shipped when the station signed up with us. And then they got a new reel, or two or three, every week. So the way... because of the way the format was executed on the air, you would have reels that were produced maybe 6 months ago or a year ago segueing into reels that were produced that week. And we had to maintain a very high level of consistency so that there wasn't any changes in level or EQ or balance or whatever when you went back and forth between the current reels and the basic library reels.
Yeah, because you'd have a song, let's say, I'm going to think of something that was sonically pretty bad. You know, Bobby Freeman's "Do You Want to Dance," okay?
Yeah.
Which sounded like it was recorded in somebody's bathroom, okay?
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes if there was something obviously wrong with the song, we would fix it. We would EQ it. We would find all kinds of problems with records, you know, back in those days. The most common problem we found was stereo tracks that had phase error on the LP or the 45. That was the huge bugaboo, because back in the 70s, a very large percentage of the listening audience was still listening on mono radios. And we had to keep things maintained phase coherency up to, you know, at least 10 kilohertz. Otherwise, you'd have frequency cancellation when you heard a stereo station on a mono radio. And the way we did that was by maintaining very, very close watch of the head alignment in the recorders, in the tape recorders. That's why each studio had a multi-frequency oscillator and a vectorscope, and all of our studio guys were trained how to use a standard alignment tape to align the heads, the playback heads, in the mastering machine using an alignment tape, and then how to align the record heads when they're producing a master reel. These are things that at a typical radio station or a recording studio, the studio personnel would never do. The chief engineer might align the head once every couple of weeks, but we did it dozens of times per day in order to keep head alignment consistent and prevent phase error, which is a function of head alignment. So I forget now. I lost my train of thought. But
well, you know, the one thing that was really bad is you'd hear a radio station that had their cart machine heads misaligned. You'd be driving down the road and they'd play a spot or play a song
on one of those cart machines.
And it would sound like it was playing underwater.
Yeah, it had a horrible, this is awful.
Yeah.
Or the vocal. Yeah. The vocal would just disappear, you know, or the vocal would be so smeared you could barely understand what the person was
saying. We came across lots of records that were produced that way. The record would sound fine in stereo, you combine it to mono, and all the high end goes away. So we would record that album track on tape and tweak the record head to compensate for the phase error that existed when they cut the master acetate. And we could, in most cases, we could fix that.
Well, an interesting story. A friend of mine in the Nashville area, who is, I want to call him a vintage country music songwriter, Jerry Foster. And Foster Rice wrote all kinds of songs. I mean, they wrote, I mean, there for a while, it seemed like if you worked at a country station and you saw an epic label, invariably the writers would be Foster Rice, you know. But he wrote a lot of the Johnny Paycheck stuff. And Paycheck recorded a song called Something About You I Love. And it was, I mean, the thing was, it was an incredible song. And it was right after he had recorded She's All I've Got and a few of these other songs. And the thing never happened. And at the station level, you never really understood it. Well, I got a hold of a copy of the single, a radio copy of it. And my goodness, the right and left channel are out of phase. So if you played it on the air, anytime you played it on the air, if a person was listening on the mono radio, he would not...
The vocal was gone.
The vocal was, on this one, it wasn't completely gone, but it was so subdued that the song just didn't sound right on the air. You know, by the time it got running through the original, the old Optimod 8000s or whatever, it just didn't sound good at all. And so later on, I discovered this, and I thought, well, no wonder this thing never became a hit, because people, you couldn't hear it, you know.
Couldn't hear it. That's sort of a problem.
Well, you know, I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, tell me a little bit about your ham radio career, I guess. I want to call it a career. It's amateur radio. But how did you first get interested in amateur radio, and what path did that take you down?
Well, I think I got first interested in ham radio through a friend of my dad who was a ham not too far from here. This would have been in about, 62 or 3 or so. And so I went over to see his station and got all, you know, interested and so forth. And I got my novice ticket in, let's see, it would have been 64 or 5 maybe. My first call was WN6UTJ, and that was back when the novice ticket was only good for a year. And it ran its course, but I didn't get around to upgrading during that year period. So a couple of years went by, and I got if you waited a year, you could reapply and get a second novice ticket, which I did. And I became WN6MEU, and then about a year later, I guess, I upgraded to general, and then it changed to WB6MEU, which is my current call. So I was a general for, I don't know, years and years, and I upgraded to advanced about, 8-9 years ago. And when I started, you know, I was on CW, mostly on 40 meters as a novice, and I had a Helicrafters SX99 receiver with a Heathkit Q multiplier, which was really necessary because that receiver was broad as a barn.
Mm-hmm.
And my transmitter, my first transmitter was a Globe something or other, Sidebander, I believe, which was one of the first sideband rigs. I think it was actually double sideband, but it would also operate in CW. So that was my first rig, and I used that for, you know, several years. And when I upgraded to general, I bought a used National NCX5 transceiver, which I still have. And it still works pretty well, actually. So, as a general, I hung out mostly on 20 meters upper sideband, and got into slow scan TV in the early 70s. And then I discovered fast scan TV in like 72 or 3, and got involved with the Southern California ATV Club. And so I was pretty active on ATV for quite a few years. I was involved with the group of guys, ATVers, who used to provide set up a TV network along the Rose Parade route for the Tournament of Roses Parade. And we did this for, 15, 20 years, whereby we set up a video repeater and had about a couple dozen camera positions up and down the parade route so we could relay live video back to the parade control point. So the folks that were running the show down there, running the Tournament of Roses parade, could see what was happening, you know, a mile or 2 miles or 3 miles down the road. We even had Tom O'Hara, who started PC Electronics many years ago. He was a pilot and owned a helicopter. So a couple of years, we even had live helicopter TV from his helicopter shooting the parade from above. So I was really into ATV for several years, and not quite as active as I used to be, but I still get on the HF bands, mostly from sitting on the beach down at Belmont Shores, California, which is an area of Long Beach, not too far from the Queen Mary. I have my portable rig, which consists of a Yaesu, I can't remember the model number. It's the little QRP rig that Yaesu makes.
I know which one you're talking about. My son David has
the little one, 5 watts or whatever it is.
Right,
runs on batteries. I have one of those and a little long wire antenna tuner, and I go down to the beach with a kite, and I fly the kite, and the kite string is made of this lightweight material called polywire, which is actually intended to be used for electric fences. It's very lightweight. Polyester cord, about maybe a 16th of an inch in diameter, with stainless steel wire that's woven through it, so it's electrically conductive.
Wow.
So I'll fly the kite up about, a couple of hundred feet and load it up through the tuner, and this whole shebang runs on a couple of lantern batteries, and I'll just sit on the beach and use usually 20 meters or sometimes 40, depending on what the conditions are doing. And it's slightly directive to the north because I'm sitting on a south-facing beach, so the onshore breeze is blowing towards the north, so my kite is sort of in the direction of north, and that's where the signal seems to want to go. But I get up and down the West Coast and up into the west end of Canada and occasionally the East Coast of the U.S., just depends literally on how the wind is blowing that day. So I guess most of my hamming these days is either sitting on the beach or doing field day occasionally.
Now let me ask you, when you're running this the kite antenna, are you running a phone or CW?
Usually phone. Yeah, in fact, always phone. Sideband, I started doing it about 10 years ago using the single-band radios that were made by, I can't think of the name.
Tentec, possibly?
Not Tentec. The company that makes all those gadgets and widgets.
MFJ.
MFJ, right.
Martin Jew, okay.
Yep. They were single-band radios, and those things actually worked really well. But if you wanted more than one band, then you had to carry more than one radio. So, but for what they are, those MFJ single-band QRP radios do a heck of a job. But the ASU works really well, too, and it's, you know, compact and multi-band and all the bells and whistles you could ask for. But that's kind of a fun thing to do, especially.
Well, how do you keep the kite aloft if you're operating the radio? Now, do you walk around with it, or how?
It just kind of hangs up there. Usually, there's enough of a breeze; it doesn't take very much. Once you get the thing launched, it'll just take off by itself, and it'll just hang up in the sky for hours on end. The wind doesn't die down till late afternoon, you know, 6-7 o'clock. So any time between about noon and 6 or 7 in the evening, once you get the kite launched, it just kind of hangs there, and you don't have to do anything to it.
I assume you could do the same thing with that with that wire you're talking about, probably with a pretty decent size helium balloon.
Yeah, we used a balloon for a field day a couple of years ago. If you're in an area where there isn't any wind, and it worked really well. We used it either as a vertical or to hold up the middle of a inverted V, but a balloon works fine for that.
Well, now let me ask you this question now. Where do you get this wire at? Because I've never seen this. I've never seen any wire that thin or that, you know.
Yeah, you get it from places that sell stuff to farms, you know, agricultural supply places and farming supply places. It's hard to find in a big city like L.A. because there aren't any farms around here, but it's made in New Zealand, and it's called Polywire. I think it's Poliwire. You could do a Google search and probably find it. But if you like at a feed and tack store or any place where they sell stuff for farming, you can find it. And it's relatively inexpensive. I think I bought a spool of 200 meters, which is over, you know, like 600 feet, for, you know, whatever, $20 or something. And I don't know how much power it'll take, because the wire that's threaded through the thin, so you probably couldn't put more than maybe 25-30 watts through it. But on the other hand, when the wire is up 200-300 feet in the sky, you don't need very much power.
Well, I was thinking that would really be cool for folks that, you know, if you're restricted space-wise and you want to run 160 meters, you could put you could do that. But you'd have to be very careful about power lines. So that was one thing that people would get.
Yeah, you do. Luckily, where I do my thing down at the beach, there aren't any power poles in the way. So even if the wind quit and the kite went down, it would just go down into the bay. You definitely wouldn't want it to be draping across utility lines. It would probably smoke your radio in a big hurry. But, if you're in an open area where you don't have power lines to worry about, it's a great, easy way to get on the air, especially on the lower bands.
Of course, if you hit a power line, it would probably operate real well as a fuse. It'd probably burn in two before it would hurt anybody, I would think, but you never know. With these high voltage lines, it could be dangerous. Now that is very unusual. Well, what kind of contacts do you normally? What do you see from where you're at? Give me an example of some of the regular type of contacts you're able to make with the kite and the QRP rig.
Well, on 40 meters up and down the West Coast, 20 meters way up into Canada, East Coast of the U.S. Into Texas, you know, it goes everywhere. And when the conditions are good, they haven't been, you know, the last few years, but when conditions are, you know, halfway decent, a 5-watt QRP sideband signal with this big old long antenna will go thousands of miles without any problem. Most people don't hear any have any problem hearing me. If I can hear them, they can usually hear me. So it's an easy thing to do, and it works pretty well.
That's incredible. So how did you happen on this idea? What caused you to want to go down this road with a kite? And
I don't know. It was just, you know, and what's that saying? An idle mind is a devil's ham radio playground or something. I don't know. I just thought, you know, must be a way to make a kite do something useful. So I started snooping around, and I think a friend of mine who lives up in Oregon had seen this polywire stuff, you know, used for what it's really intended to be used for. In other words, keeping horses and cattle from escaping their perimeter. That's what it's really used for, is electric fences. So he turned me on to it, and I tracked it down and gave it a try, and what do you know, it ends up working really well.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on board today, and I know we've talked about a number of different things. You'll have to come back, and we'll have to talk about some more of the broadcast gear, because you've got some real interesting things. Matter of fact, what was the unit's called? The Matchbox?
That was our original product that started in about 1982.
And what that was intended for, and I wanted to mention something else, too, about the Drake formats, and that is the automated formats came about without live people on the air during a period of time when FM radio was just starting to happen. And AMs were the live versions of radio, but FM was still in its budding stages, and so owners weren't really all that excited about manning an FM station 24/7 with live people.
Right, and what they usually did was they just simulcasted the AM and the FM together, but then in the early 70s, the FCC changed the rules and said, you can't do that anymore. You've got to put original programming on your FM station. So now the FM stations were sort of painted into a corner because they needed to come up with original programming that wouldn't cost very much, and automation was the answer. So if your listeners want to hear or to read all the technical ins and outs of how we did that at Drake Chenault, go to the drakechenault.org website, and there's tons of information and pictures there.
Well, the original Matchbox that you made, I remember this very well, because at that time, radio stations, a lot of stations, were wanting to use consumer cassette tech decks. They were wanting to use consumer CD players.
Yep,
and
cassettes,
all of the broadcast consoles had, you know, balanced inputs, and a lot of the inputs were XLR in nature, so the Matchbox was able. You had unbalanced inputs on it, so you could plug your consumer grade, CD player into that, and then go out of that balanced into your broadcast console. And they worked really nice. They worked really
well. Well, and the motivation for that product came from when I was working at Drake Chenault, because the earlier studios were built out of so much hi-fi gear, you know, consumer stereo gear, and as you said, it was a constant interface headache of getting that stuff to work with the consoles that wanted to see a balanced +4 low impedance input. So I built a bunch of Matchbox type devices from scratch for Drake Chenault, and then it occurred to me, I'll bet a whole bunch of other people have this same problem. And that's where the idea for the Matchbox sort of originated.
Boy, if I could have had one of those early on when I was trying to put graphic equalizers into the circuit on an AM
audio. Decks, phono preamps, equalizers, all that stuff.
Well, you know, I want you to also give out the website address for Henry Engineering, because I know there's a lot of guys out there. They've all been, like I said, we've all been motivated by Bob Heil, And a lot of the stuff that you've got are things that a lot of these fellows that are wanting to do audio into
yeah.
into
in- well yeah Henry Engineering's website is the long version is henryengineering.com, or the short version is henryeng.com. They both go to the same place. So those are your two choices. The spell it out if you know how to spell engineering, or if you can't remember, use the short version, henryeng.com.
Thank you so much, WB6MEU. Henry Landsberg. Remember the name. This fella has, this is what I call grassroots radio. and that includes amateur and broadcast at the same time. And what a milestone company that you've had, because you've got those little blue boxes are everywhere. You can't go in a radio station without seeing, you know, one, two, or maybe three of those things. And I know you made them for all different sorts of applications, not just for impedance matching and stuff. You had other devices. You had mixers, little small mixers, where you could pull two or three inputs together and pre-mix them and stick them on an input on a console. And just very innovative products that saved a lot of radio engineers a lot of headaches over a period of time. Well, thank you so much for the comments. We'll have to continue on and see how many people have the Night Kit broadcasters, and we'll move along, and then you can tell us some more stories about the Drake Chenault days. But thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Call me anytime, and we'll keep on talking.
A number of folks emailed us and asked us to repeat the section from Bill Pasternak of Amateur Radio Newsline on Walter Cronkite. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, once again, here is Bill Pasternak with Amateur Radio Newsline.
The following is an Amateur Radio Newsline special report. I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. On Friday, July 17th, a legend in broadcast journalism and in ham radio passed from the scene. That person was the man who eventually became known as the most trusted person in America. Of course, we're talking about Walter Cronkite, KB2, GSD. With a look at the man, his career, and his connection to amateur radio, here's Mark Abramovich, NT3V.
Ham radio became a late-in-life hobby to KB2 GSD, and he didn't get into it for the reasons that most of us did. In Walter Cronkite's case, he was in love with sailing and owned his own boat. It was suggested by some of his co-workers at CBS News, who were hams, that having an amateur radio station on board would be an additional measure of safety. One of those CBS hams was former ARRL director Steve Mendelson, W2ML, now with ABC.
Well, in the first 20 years of my career in broadcasting, I was fortunate enough to be an engineer for the CBS radio network. In that capacity, many of the big names of 60 Minutes, our CBS Evening News, and many of the names that became household icons passed through the little control room that I operated in, one of which was Walter Cronkite. And Walter was always interested in ham radio, but said he could never pass the code test. And for years, Walter and I shared a love of the sea. I actually retired after 30 years in the Navy and Navy Reserve as a Navy senior chief. So Walter and I would spend 15 to 20 minutes each day just talking about ham radio, talking about the Navy and his sailing.
Also working at CBS at the time as a news producer was current CQ editor Rich Moseson, W2VU. He was N2BFG back then, and an associate producer of the award-winning children's series In the News. He, along with Mendelson, were the two volunteer examiners who administered Walter Cronkite's novice class Morse test.
I remember my boss at the time, Joel Heller, WA2FFI, who was an executive producer at CBS News, calling me into his office one day, and Steve Mendelson and Walter Cronkite were sitting there, and he said, Mr. Cronkite's decided to get his ham license and wants to take his test, and Steve's going to do the written test. And this is for the novice, and would you be willing to give him the code test? So, of course, I said yes.
And what an exam it was. Back in those days, the novice came by mail and required only two higher-grade hams to administer the test. Mosesen and Steve Mendelson gave Walter his novice Morse test in a most unusual setting. Again, Steve Mendelson, W2ML.
When the talent came in and sat down in front of the microphone, you always took your tone oscillator and set a proper level into the recording devices, in this case some very, very old tape recorders. And while I had the tone up, I looked at the producer, and the producer this particular day was Rich Mosesen, now W2VU, and I started sending code just for fun. Walter sat behind the microphone, took his pencil out, and started copying. I did that for 10 minutes, picked up a copy of the New York Times, and just sent a sentence out of the Times. I think it was about, actually, three long sentences, and Richard timed it, and when we were done, I said to Walter, "How did you do?" And he read them back perfectly. So Rich and I looked at each other and said, "Yep, okay, he just passed the code test." And I hit the intercom between the control room and the recording booth, and I said, "Are you sure you couldn't pass a code test?" And he said, "No, I'd be too nervous." And I just smiled at Rich. Rich smiled at me. And I said, "Well, you just passed your code test. Now you better go study for the written."
And that was it. The FCC assigned Walter Cronkite the call letters KB2GSD. That call and his novice license were the only ones he ever held. And while he was not on the air very much, Steve Mendelson remembers one very amusing 10-meter QSO that he and Cronkite were both part of.
Walter had gotten on 10 meters without very much in the way of activity. It was a sunspot minimum that year. And so he called me on the phone and said, "Would you at least work me so I can say I've talked to somebody?" Well, little did he know, it was one of those crazy days when 10 meters was open to the Midwest, but he could barely hear me. So we're talking to each other, and suddenly a gentleman comes in from Kansas City and says, "That is the worst Walter Cronkite imitation I have ever heard." And I did the usual QRZ. He came back to me with his call sign, and he said, "Your friend does a lousy Cronkite imitation." So I turned it over to Walter, KB2GSD, this is WA2DHF. "Could you do that imitation again?" And he said, "Hi, my name is Walter, Whiskey America Lima Tango Echo Romeo, and I'm in New York City." And there's dead silence for a minute. The guy comes on and says, "Okay, you have the same first name, but come on, Walter Cronkite on ham radio? Never gonna happen." And I said to the gentleman, "Well, actually, that is Walter Cronkite." And he said, "You know, you guys from New York, all you want to do is fool people or take us in the Midwest for fools. Well, we're not." And with that, he signed off. And Walter said, "Are they all like that?"
Walter Cronkite's ham radio legacy was assured in 2002 when he agreed to narrate the ARRL-sponsored video Amateur Radio Today. Dave Bell, W6AQ, was the executive producer of that project and tells us how Cronkite's involvement came about.
Bill Pasternak and Alan Carl and I, all and Jim Haney, the president of the ARRL, we all wanted Walter Cronkite to narrate this film. And we got Bill Baker, who was the head of public television in New York City and happens to be W1BKR, to ask Walter if he'd do it, and Walter said he would. So I went to New York with my little digital video camera, and when Walter saw me in his office, I got there before he did, with a little camera, he knew that he wasn't just going to narrate this film, that he was actually going to host it. So we chatted about how much more effective it would be if he were on camera, and he agreed with me. And so he narrated the thing perfectly. We did three or four sentences at a time, and then we would pause, and then he'd go right on. And my friend Alan wrote that script, And Walter only changed one word. And it's probably the ham radio film that I am the most proud of. And it really does cement Walter's connection to amateur radio.
More on the life and the ham radio legacy of Walter Cronkite, KB2GSD, in a moment. Now, back to Mark Abramovich, NT3V, and more on the ham radio legacy of Walter Cronkite, KB2GSD.
2 years later, as broadband over powerline internet access threatened to wipe out much of the high-frequency ham radio spectrum, the ARRL again turned to Dave Bell for a video to help educate the ham radio public on this threat to its survival. The script by the late Alan Call, W6RCL, was written with Walter Cronkite in mind to narrate. The question was, would he? Once again, Dave Bell, W6AQ.
The ARRL was having no luck at all with the FCC, and they wanted the members of Congress and all of the FCC commissioners who were reasonable to understand the ARRL's position about broadband over power line, which basically just wiped out the high-frequency spectrum for hams, any place that BPL was employed. So, once again, getting Walter to host a film about BPL gave it weight that no other person in the entire country could give it. When a congressman or an executive in Washington of any kind gets a DVD and it says, narrated by Walter Cronkite, that means it's true. And I don't think that that film would have been nearly as effective with anybody else narrating it.
Walter Leland Cronkite Jr. was born in St. Joseph, Missouri on November 4, 1916. Having developed an interest in the media, in 1935 he dropped out of college in his junior year after starting a series of newspaper reporting jobs covering news and sports. Cronkite's first broadcast job came the same year when he landed an announcer's job at WKY Radio in Oklahoma City. In 1936, he met his future wife, Betsy Maxwell, while working as the sports announcer for KCMO in Kansas City. In 1950, Walter Cronkite began his television career, working at Washington, D.C. station WTOB-TV after being recruited into CBS News by the great Edward R. Murrow. On July 7, 1952, the term anchor was coined to describe Cronkite's role at the first ever telecast of the Democratic and Republican National Conventions. In the 1950s, Walter Cronkite hosted the CBS programs You Are There and The 20th Century. Later, he also hosted a game show called It's News to Me, based on news events. On April 16, 1962, Cronkite succeeded Douglas Edwards as the anchor for the prestigious CBS Evening News. Under Cronkite's 19 years at its helm, the CBS Evening News acquired a reputation for accuracy and depth in its broadcast journalism, and Cronkite himself was given the title of the most trusted man in America. This because of his professionalism and kindly demeanor when reporting. By the time Walter Cronkite retired from the Evening News on March 6, 1981, he had become affectionately dubbed Uncle Walter by his millions of nightly viewers, the same people who had earlier named him the most trusted man in America. After turning the reins of the CBS Nightly News over to Dan Rather, he went on to another career as one of the world's greatest commentators, guest speakers, and documentarians. This included hosting the annual Vienna New Year's concert on PBS and the Kennedy Center Honors Performance from Washington. In addition to appearing in the two ARRL ham radio videos, most recently he teamed up with his son Chip, producing material that aired on the new retirement TV network. Across all of his years in broadcasting and broadcast journalism, Walter Cronkite won many literary awards. And on March 1, 2006, KB2GSD became the first non-astronaut to receive NASA's Ambassador of Exploration Award. This in recognition of his support and reporting on the United States space program. On June 26, Cronkite's family issued a short statement that read, and we quote, "In order to dispel false rumors, Walter Cronkite's family want it known that, sadly, he is very ill and is not expected to recuperate. He is resting at home, surrounded by family, friends, and a wonderful medical team. We thank everyone for their prayers and good wishes." End quote. Now, Walter Cronkite, KB2 GSD, may no longer be among us, but the legacy he left behind will be a part of the world and the world of amateur radio forever. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Mark Abramovich, NT3V, reporting.
Thank you, Mark. We'll have more on the passing of Walter Cronkite, KB2 GSD, in our next newscast. That's on Friday, July 24th. For now, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, in Los Angeles. This Amateur Radio Newsline special report is copyright 2009. All rights are reserved.
Ladies and gentlemen, QSO will be back on Thursday, same time, same station, and again on Tuesday next week. So stay tuned and be sure to join us again for QSO.